Hi, everyone. Welcome back for another Fashion Law Dinner Party. I hope you've settled in with your Prosecco and appetizers. Buckle up, because we're going digital in this episode. What does that mean? Well, we're increasingly seeing the importance of virtual fashion. Digital renderings of fashion that your representations, whether they're an avatar, Bitmoji, or something else, can wear. In addition to the creation of what we might call born digital fashion, we're also increasingly seeing initiatives and projects to digitize fashion heritage. Add to this all the digital parts of our fashion existence we already have, fashion shows on YouTube, images posted on Instagram, TikTok reels, and more, and mix in the expressive quality of fashion, what do we have? A recipe for legal questions. As brands extend their trademarks to the metaverse, what does that mean for the scope of trademark rights? And copyright, for that matter. What about artists and even brands' uses of trademarks in the digital sphere? What's the line between expression, commentary, and source identification in the digital space? Is trademark use the same thing for digital fashion and fashion in the physical world? Fashion is, of course, a part of our culture. But what does the relationship between culture and fashion look like in the digital world? Before we get to fashion's present and future, oh yes, AI to digital Birkins and more, it's useful to delve into how digitization efforts are affecting our understanding of the cultural value of fashion's past, its heritage, today. Fashion's heritage might be closed in an archive, but increasingly, it's meeting us on our computers, on our phones, and in more liminal spaces wherever we are. So it's no surprise that when you ask, what's the history of scheduling Fashion Week and more industry events in New York? The answer lies in a website where you can learn all about this history and delve into so much great data. To learn more about the Fashion Calendar Research Database, which shares digitized calendars created by Ruth Finley from 1941 to 2014, and the impact of the database on our appreciation of fashion's past, I spoke to the database's architect, Natalie Newdell, a fashion and textile historian with a focus on the American fashion industry and a professor at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. Our conversation also touched on the legal and organizational nuances of putting the database together. As you'll hear, going digital isn't for the faint of heart.
Hi, Natalie. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to see you.
Hi, Felicia. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
You know, you've recently created the Fashion Calendar Research Database. And when I saw this, when you first presented it, thought it was a great example of an initiative to digitize and make available a key part of American fashion history, which we talk about, but probably not as much as, you know, we talk about European heritage brands history. And so it's definitely something that needs to be emphasized. Could you tell us a little bit about the database and the information it shares and what, you know, what instigated the creation of it? What drew you to Ruth Finley and this project?
Thank you so much for that question. It's a really layered and long answer. So I'm going to try to condense it into a cohesive but streamlined version. And so my journey researching and working with Ruth Finley and the fashion calendar started while I was in graduate school. It started on an assignment for a course that I was doing while I was at NYU. It was an exhibition about New York Fashion Week. I had discovered the fashion calendar by reading like an article in the Wall Street Journal. And I had reached out to Ruth, and my interest in the fashion calendar sort of began then. But through a series of events, I was also then proposed to work on a documentary about Ruth and the fashion calendar. I was just finishing up graduate school as a fashion and textile historian. And so for me, I felt like I really hit the jackpot, because we were introduced to Ruth in the capacity of filmmakers, but then at the same time, Ruth was just transitioning her office. She had just sold the fashion calendar to the Council of Fashion Designers of America. This was in early 2014, mid 2014. And we had spoken to her about making the documentary sort of independently. We didn't really know that she had that intention of selling her publication, or that her publication was in a transition. And so she decided to move ahead with the documentary. And as a historian, you know, Ruth's entire archive, her business archives, because it had been a private company, were in her basement, in her building, in the office, you know, on 87th Street in New York. And so I really felt like I hit the jackpot in terms of like a historical archive to work on. And so after she sold the calendar to the CFDA, she ensured that her collection was donated to an archive and would be available publicly. And so she chose the Special Collections and College Archives at the Fashion Institute of Technology. And I was given permission to sort of like go in even before it was cataloged. And I went through the entire archive. And not only for research for our film, but also because I was very interested in like writing articles about it, exploring the archive, all of those things, especially since it had been previously uninvestigated. And so I go in, and there's not only Fashion Calendar with a run from 1941 to 2014, the entire run of the publication, but also Home Furnishings Calendar, which was a sort of offshoot of Fashion Calendar, licensed to a different group of editors, that was run between 1947 and late 1951. And then also Fashion International, which was a newsletter forecasting sort of add-on to your subscription of Fashion Calendar that the office ran between the early 70s and around 2008. And so I found myself confronted with like 24 linear feet of material, which I spent like an entire summer going through, because it's sort of like organized in chronological order. Like all you could do is like just go and flip through the pages. And that's really what I did. And I got a really good feeling of not only what's in the calendars, but how it operated. And so, you know, I tell this joke, but it's really true. I remember when I was going through that database, when I was going through the archive, all I kept on thinking was like, oh, I wish I had a search bar. I wish I would be able to like search and look through this, not having to go in by calendar, date, or year. And so, you know, at that point, we were still very much making the film. I began teaching at FIT. And as I was further pursuing my historical practice, as in writing articles and all, and, you know, thinking about projects that I could work on, I spoke to our grants director at FIT and proposed taking the Fashion Calendar archive that was there and transforming it into some sort of digital humanities project. And so I collaborated with Karen Trevette, who's the head of Special Collections and College Archives, where we are co-PIs on the project. And we brought in Joseph Anderson, who's the digital humanities librarian at FIT, and who is the lead developer of the actual like technical part of the database. We had, and then I'll go on to tell you more about the design later, but ultimately we had other, you know, advisors and staff on the project. And that, and so we, before all, you know, all of that came together, essentially we had chosen, or, you know, identified a potential funder, because these types of things are not only expensive, but also very time consuming. And so we were lucky enough to find the Council of Library and Information Resources. They are a re-granting organization that works with libraries very much within the digital humanities space. And they are mainly funded from the Mellon Foundation. And so they have a grant category called Digitizing Hidden Collections. And so we applied for that category. It took us a couple of applications to really get the application right. But they, what was really great about that process is that they gave us feedback and they were very encouraging. And so we were able to get the necessary language that we needed and the design that we really wanted to do and put it into that application. And in 2020, we were granted the funding to start working on the project. And although we had anticipated it being a 2-year project, it ended up being a 3-year project. And that's when we launched in November of 2023.
Yeah, I can imagine what a huge job for you to do. I mean, just from the organization, but then also, you know, thinking about how to organize it. I mean, both in its, you know, in the first from the linear and then in a computer based model. So before we talk about that design, which is so fascinating and goes really to the heart of, you know, preserving fashion heritage digitally and for the future, I imagine that in your grant, you also had to, you know, sell sort of the importance, right, the cultural significance of digitizing the fashion calendar. And I'm struck by how you said, you know, for Ruth, this was obviously a private business archive that she kept. And then, you know, it became, when you started looking at it as a fashion historian, I mean, I would say more like publicly, culturally interesting. Could you talk, although of course the fashion calendar was always of interest as a public resource, right? To see like what was on, what was being shown and what shows were being organized. So could you talk a little bit about how you think about, you know, why the public is interested in the fashion calendar and what value it has for the public?
So that's a great question, and it's multi-pronged. So I think just like baseline, the fashion calendar as a publication and the information and content that it has within it is of major value to the public, to researchers, to students more broadly, for a multitude of reasons, including that it is truly interdisciplinary. It truly reflects the layered, multi-dynamic sort of fashion industrial complex that integrates popular culture, celebrity, textiles, manufacturing, craft, labor, gender, race, so many different elements of American and even global culture is represented in the fashion calendar. Further, it's a unique archive. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And it's extremely granular in its information and very contained, right? You have from like 1941 to 2014 in the same format for over 70 years with like the same type of information on an almost minute to minute basis with all of the information someone would need, right? Like the who, what, when, where, how. All of the information of what was the goings on in the past. And so looking at the information in the calendars, like for me, that's what really convinced me that this would be a valuable resource. When I went through the public, when I went through the archive the first time, I was amazed by how much information was in the material itself. And I realized how much there really is something for everyone. And so, the fashion calendar, just as a publication, just like as a paper-based archive, is fascinating in that way. And then, and obviously fashion is something that is more and more mainstream and much more understood by the public and of interest to the public, which I think, you know, is why in many ways underpinning with this conversation. Like this is why we think about this.
Yes, there's like a historization of a fashion now that's happening. And of course, you know, you talk about this and you address this in your own work. But I mean, it's so interesting to see how fashion, thinking about the historical why of fashion, what the cultural meanings of fashion, it's really had a renaissance. Over the past couple decades. I mean, maybe we could say since the mid 80s, you know, with the Yves Saint Laurent show at the Met, of course, the increased interest in fashion will spill over to a digital resource like the fashion calendar.
For sure. And the second prong of this is the potential of the archive for innovative, experimental digital humanities. And I know we'll talk about that in some of your later questions, but why I think the how we sold it, essentially, how you were saying to the funder, is, you know, their category was called digitizing hidden collections. Now, arguably, is the fashion calendar archive hidden? No, it's at Special Collections and College Archives at FIT in New York City, where you could call or email and request to see, you know, go in there and request to go see the fashion calendars. You know, the institute, the archive is essentially open to the public. Mm-hmm. However, in its paper-based format, the richness of the publication was hidden, because the only way you could really enter or start looking into the publication was by time period, right? You had to have a date or a range or whatever and start looking at it in that way. But when you look at the fashion calendar, it is this amazing resource to be able to produce patterns and more quantitative information, because as we know, the fashion and artistic communities in New York City and around the world are deeply interconnected, as well as, you know, it over 70 years, there's many organizations, people, et cetera, that have, you know, been there for longer periods of time, shorter periods of time, popped in for one season, you know, things like that. So how are you able to trace that? How are you able to actually really extract the richness of the publication in a way that goes above and beyond its actual, you know, material form? It's not only digitizing, right, which entails scanning each issue and putting them, you know, in some online repository, which is very valuable, you know, and which we are doing, right, on the Fashion Calendar Research Database. You could go in by issue, you could flip through them as if you were at Special Collections,
right,
and really like feel that, you know, obviously you're not touching the paper, but you're looking at really high res images of the paper and be able to look through the archive in a virtual way. But applying the AI tools and all of this stuff to extract the information and then use digital humanities sort of like tools and technologies to inform additional search optimization, data visualization, mapping, all these things, that took the project to not only just a digitization project, it's a digital humanities project that's really exploring and interacting with how we could use text-based archives in ways that are much more dynamic than, you know, just flipping through the pages.
Oh, the graphs are incredible. I mean, for anyone who's listening, like if you just, you know, put in one word in the search bar, the graphs, the, you know, the data is incredible. Yes. That you get. So before we get into, you know, the data and critical cataloging, which I learned about through, you know, your presentation, your work, I wanted to ask you, Natalie, especially because we might have some lawyers listening in, what were some of the challenges that you faced when you were digitizing? I was very struck by how you mentioned that Ruth Finley sold her rights in the fashion calendar to the CFDA right around the time when, you know, you started looking at the fashion calendar and thinking about it as a cultural resource. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how you managed that? You know, how did you manage the rights issues? How did you, you know, interact with the CFDA if you did, you know, what, I mean, how did you do that? Because also it's so multi-layered and really also another huge responsibility.
Totally. It's a huge responsibility. And, you know, I am not an attorney. And I think even for intellectual property attorneys, intellectual property is still even somewhat hazy.
Yes, there are new issues popping up all the time. And that's actually part of these conversations. It's like, okay, we know you're not an attorney. We know, you know, you're not in the law. But so often, right, archivists and fashion historians have to make these decisions kind of in the shadow of the law, often without the advice of an attorney, because, you know, it's time sensitive and all of this other stuff. So absolutely.
And also often I find when I get advice, it's not like, oh, you should do this. It's like, well, if you do this, then, you know, maybe, and then this, and then that. And it's like, okay, but what's the answer?
Right. The classic legal.
What to do.
Yeah, the classic legal, it depends, but no one really wants to tell you. Yes.
And I'm like, tell me. So, so it's interesting. So Fashion Calendar is an interesting publication for, well, I think it also is reflective of so many other publications that were, you know, were started in home offices by young women in the early 20th century, which I don't know how many there were, but there clearly were some because Fashion Calendar is one of them. To be honest with you, there's no, at least from what I understand, there's no record of like any initial trademark filing or anything like that when they started the publication.
Okay.
What I have found and what I do know is that in 1973, Ruth filed for a trademark for Fashion Calendar. It was granted in 1976. But what's interesting about it is that it's not, doesn't only trademark essentially like the fashion calendar, like as a publication, which it is, that's part of it, but it's essentially like the act of scheduling fashion week.
Oh, that's interesting. So the category of goods is publication, but then also it's the activity.
I think so. It's not only a calendar, it's like to be the scheduler of fashion week. So, and I believe Ruth filed for that in the 70s, because by the 70s, the American fashion industry had reached an ascendancy and a sort of pseudo organization, you know, prior to, you know, it was after the establishment of the CFDA, but the CFDA had not begun really overseeing the fashion industry in the way it does today.
Sure, we can think of the Battle of Versailles. I mean, the 70s was the time when American fashion really was ascendant and became exactly a point of reference in comparison to Paris, too.
And, exactly. And so I think, so there's that. And then also there was an organization that was forming called the New York Fashion Council that was getting together to sort of, as a group, determine the fashion market dates in New York City in relation to global fashion dates, because in the 70s also this like global fashion circuit was starting to articulate more and more, you know, foreign press was starting to come to New York in much higher amounts, and the same vice versa. And so it seems to me that at that moment Ruth went forward with that to protect her publication and her role as the, you know, like the unique scheduler, and to also maintain the publication's centrality to the entire industry.
Right. As the person who, when you see the fashion calendar, you think of, right, Ruth Finley and her fashion calendar. Right.
Exactly. And in many ways, like that's what also gave the New York Fashion Council, you know, legitimacy, that was the time system that Ruth's calendar was on. And so I actually, I have a book that is coming out in July called In American Fashion, Ruth Finley's Fashion Calendar. It's going to be published by Bloomsbury. And I talk about this in the book, the time period of when these moves were made. But it's very interesting because, so essentially when Ruth sold the fashion calendar to the CFDA, when the CFDA essentially acquired it, and, you know, many organizations and entities had wanted to purchase the calendar from Ruth for many years, because it was such an important and it remains to be an important instrument and symbol for American fashion. Essentially, what she sold was the rights to schedule, the trademark, the rights to schedule Fashion Week, and the fashion calendar, the archive, her back archive that she had in her, you know, in her storage
basement.
Was not part of that sale. However, it was understood and communicated that Ruth's intention was to donate it to an educational institution and make it available to students and the public. And of course, the CFDA was very supportive of that. And so when her office was being transitioned, all of the, you know, her office documents, and also we have to remember that Ruth's archive and her business archive and documents, what they were in 2014, 2015, were very different than what they probably were in the past, for many reasons, including, you know, when you have a business for that long, you start getting rid of documentation.
Yeah.
And not only that, she had, I think it was in sometimes in the 90s, apparently there was like a flood in the basement of her building. And so there was like loss there as well. And so, you know, loss that is unknown loss. Like
yes, of course. No, this is fast. Yeah. It's fascinating what you mentioned, because there's this real division between like the IP rights, right. And assets of the company, and the tangible physical, you know, corporate record of the company that is also, you know, as we know, susceptible to, you know, natural disasters, whether it's a flood or a fire. So yes, I mean, that's fascinating.
That, and also, you know, something else that I think is not spoken about, or at least I have, you know, something it's more that I experienced, you know, like after someone passes away, what happens to your documents, where they go, you know, how they're dealt with, all that stuff also very much affects like what's in the historical record and what's available. So,
yeah. And for fashion brands, you know, that are family oriented too, that's, you know, that becomes even more complicated. I mean, you've got great examples like Ferragamo where the, you know, archiving and the preservation is just, you know, the example and it's, you know, everything is preserved and then you have examples, you know, where just a designer, you know, he's one person and they don't have anyone that wants to take it on. And so it just goes into the ether, you know, of a fashion. You don't know even where it goes. Maybe it's divided between different institutions. Maybe, you know, and then of course, as a researcher, you know, for us, that's such a challenge because you're like, great. I mean, it can be fun if you want to travel to five different places, but it's also, you know, really challenging for the holistic, you know, nature of
that, and that's considering the documents are even saved, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, considering that they are and they're not trashed, you know, or in a bin somewhere.
Which I think is, you know, also the case for so many situations.
Yeah.
So essentially, when Ruth donated her archive to Special Collections and College Archives at FIT, she donated it in 2015. Essentially, she is, you know, she signed an agreement with them. And technically, you know, Ruth owns the copyright, but it's also interesting because, you know, Home Furnishings Calendar, there's no documentation about who owned that, even though I believe Ruth and Alice Hughes licensed the concept to these other editors, which is not only what Ruth told me, it makes sense because the only archive that exists of this publication was in Ruth's possession, mm-hmm. and their names pop up sporadically within it, but also like who owns that copyright? It's that would be like almost virtually impossible to know who even was licensing it, who's the copyright holder of the IP, because it was based on a license of the concept of the fashion calendar. Mm-hmm. We don't even have the origin documents of the fashion calendar. So I don't, you know, there were multiple women involved in its origination. So it gets very fuzzy in terms of that stuff. But ultimately, the joy of this is that it's an educational project.
Yes.
And not only is it an educational project, but because we were seeking funding, the funder had very specific requirements as per the rights and as per sort of all the legal elements of it. So when we decided to pursue this grant, I had spoken to FIT's legal department and they advised me to not only speak to the CFDA and get communication with the CFDA just to get their, you know, ultimately, even though it's in the FIT's hands, it's best to get, you know, permission and letters and approval. Thing is more of like an educational archive, but yes. Ultimately, not only did we want the support of the CFDA to do this, but just for any potential future legality, it was very important to like preempt anything. So there was that element of it. The next entity that we wanted to speak to, and you know, by that time Ruth had passed away. Ruth passed away in 2018, and we really started looking at. I really started talking about this right before she had passed away, and so we had started talking about the potential to digitize everything. And the reality is that Ruth wanted everything digitized. Like she gave the archive to FIT, assuming that they would digitize it off the bat. She thought that they, of course, they would do that. So she, you know, so in many ways, her family, who I'm very close to, was extremely supportive of the project for many reasons, including they know this is something that Ruth would have wanted, but also they understand the richness and the value of the database and of the archive, and that it would be an even richer source as a database. And so I spoke to Ruth's family. At the time, Ruth's late son, Joe Green, who is an attorney himself, was involved in just, you know, supporting and signing off on documents and for rights, etc. Because
if the copyright was Ruth's, then exactly. Her heirs inherited it, so he needed to sign off, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And so, and it was also sort of funny because you know, they had given a bunch of stuff to FIT while Ruth was still alive. And then after Ruth passed away, there was, you know, more boxes and stuff and calendars and whatever that they had given me. And then I had found some stuff in those boxes that I wanted to add to the fashion, to the FIT collection. But it was so funny because I needed to essentially get them to sign another letter with FIT. It sort of didn't matter that they gave it to me because sure. they had not signed a letter with me.
Sure. So now you're talking about the tangible like box.
Yes, exactly. Off.
Yeah. No, this is so fascinating because even if you're digitizing, right, you still have tangible things you need to think about. Okay. Who signed the gift and donation deed, right? Who, what are the terms? What, are, you know, I mean, all of that stuff that would go into a, you know, a deed of gift. So
exactly. So yeah. the deed of gift and then, you know, letters and, you know, specific documentation that luckily, because, you know, I'm affiliated with an institution, FIT's legal department was able to, you know, get documents together that all of the project supporters signed. And, you know, again, because it's an educational thing, all of this is available open source. We're not making any money off of this. All of this is available to the public. All of it is free. Nothing is like password protected. Mm-hmm. This, of course, very much helped and encouraged even more support because, you know, that was one of the major things. This, for the CFDA, they were like, we love this. You know, as long as as long as nobody is making money off of this, they're thrilled. Everybody is thrilled for this information to be available to the public and to see where it could be taken. So all of those were very carefully sort of mediated and discussed well in advance. And so when we were able to go to our funder, we had all of these documents in place, which gave them the confidence to then grant us the funding, because that's obviously a concern of theirs in any case, like thinking about copyright and that's also something. So we made all of the, not only the images and like the scanned material from the database available with the Creative Commons 4.0 attribution license, which essentially means all of the images on the fashion, all of the scanned material that you could find on the fashion calendar database can be used, reproduced, reprinted, as long as there's attribution. And not only that, the metadata is also available. That was also required per our grant. And not only that, the coding, the sort of the GitHub sort of algorithm and data and coding that was developed to essentially run the database is also available publicly.
Yeah. So that's so great because your story about kind of the back end of the creation of the fashion calendar database and then the front end really, you know, match each other in the sense that, you know, this is a cultural project where you work directly with Ruth Finley and her heirs. And it's so different from the fashion calendar as a business, right? That's still put out by the CFDA. And so the commitment you make on the back end of the database is really the same on the front end. I mean, the metadata is available, right? Just say where you got it, right? So, I mean, that's really inspiring because when we think about what public access means, you know, it means also making a commitment on the front end when you, you know, make it available to the public. So that's really inspiring, especially as you were talking about AI and all the great, you know, the technological tools that you're using to create, you know, new graphs, to create new images, to put information together in different ways.
Thank you. Yes. So it's, you know, it was really important for me and our team to make it public no matter what. And also I think more and more as we were saying, this like fashion history, design history content is more and more available on the internet and on social media, and there are more and more experts and all that stuff. I think that the fact that so much of this information is gatekept by, you know, private databases or databases that require library access or institutional affiliation or library, you know, I think that putting things behind pay codes or whatever. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the word.
No, paywalls, you're right. I mean, one of the, you know, I had access to the FIT database when I, interned at the museum, and it's one of the things I miss the most because there's so much info. You know,
absolutely. There. And I think that, you know, when you have library access, you have access to like a world of information that's in many times vetted or critiqued or whatever. What I'm experiencing is that I'm seeing, and no shade, I think that there's a lot of amazing creators out there who put a lot of time and effort into like really focusing on very valuable information. But more often than not, I experience misinformation for everything. You know, it's not just fashion information. This is a huge effect of social media that is pervasive and that we're definitely talking about, this idea of like misinformation and the perpetuation of it, like around, excuse me, around last fashion week, there's a TikToker. I don't even have TikTok, but I saw this. One of my former students sent this to me. There was a TikToker who did, his whole thing is that he like will do like a little vignette story about like the history of something in New York. And sometimes they're really fun and they're really light and they're really engaging and he has a huge following. And so it was right before the last fashion week and he does a whole post on like the history of the fashion calendar and fashion week. And none of it, like he attributed like the start of the fashion calendar to Eleanor Lambert, like all of the information was wrong. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, I've written extensively about the fashion calendar. There's a documentary about the fashion calendar. There's so much publicly information available out there. One would not even need to go and have library access or anything like that. And they still got it wrong. And so I think it's so important to make these primary sources, these very quality sort of resources available publicly, because I think as there's more and more interest, putting everything behind a paywall just makes it more difficult for everyone to get, you know, like what's the real story.
Oh, I think that's such an important point that you mentioned, because we have this, you know, assumption often. I think now perhaps it's less of a widely held assumption than it was maybe even 10 years ago, that if you put something on the web, you know, or you access it or you make it publicly available, that means that it's right in terms of information, but also that it's free to use. And, you know, if we've learned anything with the application of, you know, copyright to the internet and to social media, but I mean, this is exactly what you're saying, right? This idea that it becomes digitizing, and this is so important for future fashion heritage, digitizing actually adds more rights or can add more rights. And in a world where we want to argue fair use, right, it makes it harder sometimes, also because of the spectrum of culture and commerce on which we operate.
No shade. I completely understand organizations that have to have paywalls. Like all of this is extremely expensive. All of the, you know what I mean? Like there's
Yeah,
there's so many implications. And like we got a grant and I still had to work for an entire year unpaid. You know what I mean? So it's a value assessment, I think, when it comes down to it.
Yeah, and definitely a value assessment that I think your project is so forward-looking in this way, because as we think about digitizing more aspects of American fashion history, and even we think of, you know, designers as gatekeepers. I mean, I always think of like Ralph Lauren as the heir, that kind of the U.S. heir to Giorgio Armani, right? This idea that, you know, it's his brand and what's going to happen to his brand when, you know, someone else, right, takes it over, and what does that preservation look like? And so you're talking about gatekeeping. Well, brands gatekeep too, you know, both in terms of the physical access, but also the digital, even more so in digital times. And so, you know, what you mentioned is also something that's really important to think about prospectively. You know, how do we assess the value of a digital asset like the fashion, you know, calendar database, and what number do we assign to that when it, like most cultural heritage, it's invaluable. You know, you can't really put a number on it, but you have to for the people who create it and the people who, you know, work on it, and it has to be respected, I would say too. So, you know, this is fascinating, Natalie, and you've shared so much information about the back end. Thank you so much for all of this, because this is so, so insightful and so much to learn from. What are some of the most fascinating stories that you've discovered through your research, you know, on Ruth Finley's fashion calendar? You've talked about, you know, the AI models, that we've talked about the data, we've talked about how you, you know, how you put it together and everything, how you negotiated. We've talked also about, you know, future fashion heritage and the cultural interest of it. But are there any vignettes that you could share that also would, you know, encourage people, as if we need another reason to go to the database? But I mean, is there anything that really struck you as just fun from your work?
So much of the information in the fashion calendar reflects an element of fun because it's so event driven and, you know, PR event driven, this idea of like captivating the press or the public for either fashion shows or social events or anything like that. But I think when you look at a lot of the listings listed by like labor organizations and women's organizations, which there are dozens listing in the fashion calendar throughout its period, but especially in the earlier part of the run, you really see this very sort of like interesting reflection of what was going on in terms of labor and broader things in the industry, which for me, especially with my research focus and interest, is particularly interesting. And I think one that I actually quote in the book that's coming out is there was a talk that was co-hosted by Alice Hughes, who is one of the founders of Fashion Calendar, and Doris Fleischman, who was married to Edward Bernays and is, you know, noted mother of PR and PR techniques. And the title of the talk was, "Do Women Make Good Ad Men?" And it was a whole conversation about the values and virtues of going into publicity for women and all the different types of opportunities and all of these things. And especially in that period, there are many sort of talks and panels and a lot of discussion about women entering the workforce and very much in these roles that weren't necessarily actual making of the clothing, you know, all these other types of, which in that context would have even been seen as somewhat more of like a professional element of the fashion industry, you know, like not working in the sweatshop making the samples, but another sort of entry point for women that were deemed sort of like upwardly mobile and like respectable in the 1940s, etc. And so there are all these conversations about like what sort of places in the industry women could be in. And so I love these, to me, like reading that, like, do women make good ad men? Question mark. It's just like these, the language of it all is very entertaining to me. So a lot of stuff like that is very amusing, but then you also see, you know, amazing reflections of the multi-layered elements of popular culture and like so many different people and entities and designers and celebrities and people sort of intermingling at these events. What I hope and what is the next future stage of this database is to sort of like use it as a scaffolding to build out visual and video content to add to the fashion shows or events to sort of give this next more experiential elements to navigating the calendar, which I think would even, you know, expose those ties even more.
I'm imagining like a visual, you know, Mad Men-esque, right, part of your database where, you know, there are videos and as you mentioned, you know, previous advertisements and previous videos of shows. Gosh, that would be amazing. That would be so great.
And I also think that, you know, I think the Vogue archive and the Women's Wear Daily archive are fantastic. And they're very valuable in terms of the information they provide. But I think the Fashion Calendar database has this ability to potentially like link out to so many other media that an archive or even like a digital archive that's more privately driven or based on like a company archive that's privately driven isn't doing. So
Yes, it can be a hub. Your database can basically be a hub.
That's what I'm hoping to. I'm hoping in the future it can go in that direction.
Yeah. Oh, Natalie, that's so inspiring. And just one more reason to go visit your database and get lost in all the great data and the graphs and all the information. So thank you so much for talking with me about this project. And I can't wait to see how it develops. And I hope everyone visits the database. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Felicia, for inviting. Firstly, thank you for participating in the Archiving Fashion Conference. Your presentation with Lucrezia Palandri was excellent. Thank you so much for inviting me here today. I'm so excited to share the database with your listeners. And I welcome everyone to fashioncalendar.fitnyc.edu and browse away.
One thing particularly jumped out at me during my conversation with Natalie, the divide between the tangible and intangible in fashion and law. You might have heard this when Natalie and I discussed the trademark Ruth Finley registered on the principal register at the United States Patent and Trademark Office for the word fashion calendar as applied to, and I'm quoting here, a newsletter listing events in the clothing and fashion field. That intangible property right, a trademark, which was sold to the CFDA, is very different from the tangible documents and other archival material that Ruth Finley donated to Special Collections at FIT, and which now has allowed for the creation of a very different type of intangible property made available to the public, data and images of the original archival information. And this different type of intangible property is put to a purely educational, academic use. In the fashion calendar database example, it might be relatively easy to differentiate between the intangible trademark still used to signal the scheduling of the commercially oriented New York Fashion Week by the CFDA, and the separate, intangible, educational, not-for-profit resource of the fashion calendar's past that is made available online. In other examples, especially when fashion accessories and clothing go digital, the divide between different types of intangible properties and tangible properties, trademarks and goods, might not be so evident. So, how do trademarks work in the digital space? How do fashion brands put a halt to digital renderings of their goods and leverage their trademarks and other IP rights, including copyright, to sell their fashion and leverage their brand heritage and market share? What's the difference between trademark law and copyright law for digital fashion? And in addition to today's legal challenges, what's the future of digital fashion, especially as AI becomes more prevalent? Our journey into digital fashion is just getting started. This was the first course. So join me for the second part of this fashion law dinner party when I speak to the celebrated IP legal scholar Mark McKenna and to Elena Varese from DLA Piper in Milan.